Really excited. This week's edition of the Sports Media Podcast we do across Arizona, pick out an Arizona person, a personality, writer, someone on the media end, and even on a national stage. This week, it's Bob Baum, who's retired from the Associated Press last week after a 43-year career. I've known Bob Baum in headline style, byline, I should say, of Bob Baum, Associated Press, track and field. He is a legend in the business in that regard, and he's a legend in Valley Media. All the teams paid great homage to him, and he's still on the right side of the grass. He joined us in studio. Yeah. That's, you know, it's the way it works. 10 Olympic Games. Yeah. You've been out of it for a week. Do you miss it?
I've had too much to do to miss it.
Yeah?
Give me a week or two, and I'm sure I will, but I'm going to miss parts of it. There's no, parts of it I'm not going to miss.
What don't you miss so far?
What don't I miss?
A weekend. What don't you miss?
Interstate 10 is the main thing I don't miss. I don't miss having to jump into the middle of spring training because it never was my favorite thing in the world because it drags on forever and has
and you know what they're gonna
incremental
say.
Meaning by day by day. Those are probably the main things are the lack of stress, you know, because every day I cover three teams, something was going on, it seemed like, in one of them. And that part I don't miss, you know. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they say, oh, the Cardinals signed somebody. See, I don't have to worry about that today.
Yeah, that's good. You, as I mentioned, I've always known you as the premier track and field writer for Associated Press. And I'm sure you'll say, well, there's other guys that you should consider. But, Bob, 10 Olympic Games, and I think 7 of them were summers, yeah. And 3 of them were winters. And so when you talk about the players that you covered, the athletes that you covered, and I mentioned this to you off the air, you have to start with steroids. You have to start with cheating. And you have to, you know, if I'm going to run down the list of Ben Johnson and Marion Jones and Tim Montgomery and Carl Lewis and others.
Gee, I covered all of those people.
You covered all of them, but you were on the forefront of that, and it would be disrespectful to you and your career to not talk about. That was not an easy sport to cover because you were doing so much away from it. Or am I wrong in that?
Well, we probably should have been doing more than we were doing because it took a while to get this regulations in place to kind of put a hold on this whole
thing. When did you first realize there was something going on?
Well, the minute you start covering the sport because it was just common knowledge. In the 1980s, steroid use was rampant, especially in the communist bloc countries, East Germany. There's and I cannot remember her name, but she holds the world record in the women's 400 meters. If you look that record up, and it was from, I believe, 88, right in there, it was, nobody has even touched it since then. I mean, 2 seconds of the thing since then. There's so many telltale signs like that it was just obvious.
The yellow eyes of Ben Johnson, right?
Well, I saw Ben Johnson run that 100 meters in Seoul, and it was like watching a robot churn through this thing.
Boop, boop,
and then we had the news conference afterwards, and it went on. The wait went on and on and on, and it was hours before he actually finally showed up. Now, I believe it turned out that he was allegedly trying to give a urine sample and wasn't able to, but it was within a couple of days, and it broke during the overnight period over there. He tested positive, you know, never ran in the sport again.
Yeah.
And the people, the guy that coached him ended up coaching Marion Jones for a time. And I've written a number of articles on Marion Jones because she's the most charming woman in the world. Amazingly talented person. Mm-hmm. But the crowd she hung out with was always the part that made you suspicious. Mm-hmm. Her husband and I'm horrible with names now, but he was a shot putter, tested positive, reports came out in Sydney, and there was this packed news conference, and she came out and said this little statement and split immediately, and then he was left to take the the guy who was on the stand with was listed as his nutritionist was the was the guy, I can't think of his name either, I just now thought of it, the guy who ran the lab in San Francisco. So And he was listed as his, quote, nutritionist.
So the nutritionist.
Lots of good nutrition.
There's a different. So if we were to go through the 10 Olympics, give me the cities or the venues. Do you remember all of them?
Also, I got 4 world track championships, which were cool.
So the Olympics, the ones you went to.
Yeah. Sydney was the best.
And you went to L.A.?
L.A., yeah.
Seoul?
I went to every Olympics between Los Angeles and Beijing.
How did you land the gig?
I was a sports writer in Portland, and there are a lot of big track meets in Eugene.
Yep.
And I'd go down and help Bert Rosenthal, who was my mentor in the track writing gig, and I was always his right-hand man, I guess, until later on, and people moved around a little bit. But that's what got me my foot in the door. Mm. Steve Prefontaine was in the same class as I was at college at the University of Oregon. So I've always loved track and field. I still love it, even though I haven't covered it in 10 years. I just love the personalities involved, the what it takes to succeed, mm-hmm. Beyond the drug part of it, some of the success stories of overcoming horrible obstacles to succeed. There's all of that in track and field, and it's not covered heavily, so it's kind of a wide open space when you're out there.
So AP comes to you and says, we want to hire you to cover track and field. Is that how the conversation went?
No, I was already working for the AP. I went to work in 75, but all of a sudden I started getting more attention, and the breakthrough was LA when I got to go to the LA Olympics, because up to that time I'd just done the local stuff, mm-hmm. and I did the Final Four that year, and then I did it just evolved from there, you know.
When did you know you were good at it?
The track part of it?
Yeah, just in general. Let's go track. When did you know you could do this? Like, I think all of us get in the profession of media, and it's, I don't know if we're going to make it here. In track, I would think you're covering it in the rain and times, and you're...
There were some weird situations, but I don't know. I guess I've always kind of had a confidence that I was pretty good at what I was doing, even if I wasn't.
Yeah. You put on a good face.
Yeah, right. And, you know, I tried to just... ask a lot of questions and understand the sport, because you know there's a lot of 100 meters doesn't seem like much time to evaluate anything, but it's all about the getting out of the blocks and what you do the first 20 meters and what you do the last 20 meters, and it's just kind of understanding each event, I guess. I just love the environment, I guess, and the...
Who's your favorite athlete in doing that?
In track?
Track.
Oh, boy.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah,
and you've covered the biggest names.
A lot of them, and much of it was in the past. One of my favorites, and it's because of his story and the fact I got to tell it first, is Lopez Lamont from NAU, who lost Boy Sudan.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Escaped the rebel camp, spent 10 years in a Kenyan refugee camp, got brought over here as a lost boy of Sudan, figured out he could run, wound up running at NAU, which is when I talked to him, won the NCAA championship, made the Olympic team, ended up carrying the U.S. flag, became a U.S. citizen, mm-hmm. and carried the U.S. flag in Beijing. That's one of my stories that I just love, and he was the nicest guy. I mean, I haven't seen him in few years, but he was one of the nicest guys to have ever dealt with in my life.
And hardest athlete in track and field to deal with?
Carl Lewis.
Because?
Just hard to get to. He was protected.
Once you got to him, was he good?
I guess.
But yeah, it was all the layers.
I thought it was a lot of talk. You know, he was a real talker, but amazing athlete. And that was at L.A., of course, where he won all the medals. It was 5 gold medals, but he's just difficult to deal with. But then there were a number of mm-hmm. guys that were difficult. A lot of the sprinters are a bit prima donnas.
How do you work a story, and this is more geared towards a college student that's watching this or listening to this, and covering track and field and just attaching themselves to a beat that not everybody else is attaching themselves to. I know when I've taught at Cronkite or when I go speak, I get a lot of, I want to be in football, I want to cover baseball, I want to cover e-gaming, I want to cover college basketball. Nobody says track.
Right. Every 4 years, they will. That's when it becomes a sport.
Consistent gig, right?
Yeah, but every 4 years is when it gets on the national scene.
Or every 2 years when you go to the finals, right? You have the
World Championship. They're actually the year before and the year after.
Okay.
Got me to Paris on the company's money, so.
It's a good gig if you can get it.
Right. But that's if you're given the opportunity to cover it all the time. See, we weren't. I still had my Oregon stuff to do, and I was covering the NBA playoffs. But the more time you get, the more time you get to know these people, know their agents, and then when the mob shows up in the Olympic trials, they know who you are because
you've been there.
Yep. You've been there. I go over to practice at UCLA.
Drake Stadium, is it?
I don't know. I can't even remember where it is. But I'd go over there to interview various athletes way before the trials. So you try to get, what you try to do is just establish connections, especially if they'll.
In any sport, but in track and field, because it is one-on-one.
Right.
So you go to the events where nobody's there, builds up. Then at the Olympic Games, you're already known and you can get access. Except, if we're talking to a college kid or somebody who wants to
do this. Right. You got to work your way up to that, though. Somebody's not going to just say, hey, you go to the Olympics. You got to kind of have certain shown that you know what you're doing to get yourself to that position. But you show you know what you're doing by working your way up. But I'm a big believer in that anyway. I'm not one of, I see a lot of people want to jump in and, cover presidential campaigns for the Washington Post right out of college or something. I mean, I really believe in starting small and working up.
The idea of paying your dues is something, but also learning.
Right.
Just learning. We could go on a full hour on gaffes that I've seen of people complimenting shoes that the first lady's wearing rather than, that's not why you're there. It's not why we paid you to go to do this. We're talking with Bob Baum. He has left the Associated Press after a great 43-year career on a national space, but in a local space. Why did you leave Portland to come to Phoenix and when? What was the attraction?
It's kind of funny what happened. I was covering the Western Conference Finals for the NBA, which I did a number of years, no matter who was in it. And I believe it was Utah and L.A. It was Utah and somebody. But I was in Salt Lake, and the finals had started with Michael Jordan and the Bulls, and I was helping with that. And this job was open. They'd actually created a second job here because of the Diamondbacks' establishment of a baseball team. And a guy had taken the job and then backed out at the last minute, so they were scrambling around. And Terry Taylor, the sports editor, mentioned to me almost in passing, you wouldn't want that job, would you? I mentioned it to my wife, and she said, take it. And the reason is because in Portland I was doing half and half, half news, half sports. And that's not the case anymore up there, but that's the way it was then. And it was good for me. I'm covering the salmon run issues on the Columbia River, plus I'm doing all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And it was good for me, but down here it was a full-time sports gig, work out of my house, Pretty much, the way the job was structured then, I did whatever I wanted to, and then the other guy, would do the rest. And it's just too good of a job. And I did not apply for it. I mean, they came
and asked you.
And they flew me in to talk me into it, flew my wife down here, and not knowing they didn't need to talk her into it, but they tried anyway. And it was just a good move for us at that point in time. And it worked out well, I think. With the exception of the 300-degree summers, I like it fine.
First event you covered in Phoenix when you got here. Do you remember it?
Probably a baseball game because I got here in July.
Of?
1998.
Okay.
Diamondbacks' first year.
So they were well on their way to 100 losses. But
And the place was full every night. They had beer on tap in the press box.
Yep.
That all changed to soft ice cream, and then
the hot dogs are still the same.
And then they took the soft ice cream away. So these are the important things to a sports writer. My line is, you're not a real sports writer till you complain about the quality of the free food.
So. That's good. We've been in a market where there's been so many good guys to deal with.
Really true.
People will say this is a soft market. I would say that you have to understand what you're living in out here. It is paradise for 7 months, and then it's hell for about five, okay? So when a guy like Mike D'Antoni comes in, he is a perfect fit for what goes on here. When I got here, Paul Westfall was the coach, and he was a perfect fit for what goes on here. Bob Brenly was a perfect fit. Buck Showalter was kind of an awkward fit, I thought. But if I go down all the coaches and people here in the market, Dave McGinnis was a great fit.
Love Dave McGinnis.
Yeah. But Vince Tobin was kind of an odd ball, an odd duck.
Right. Dennis Green.
Dennis Green.
Tough
to deal with. Look at his body of work. Larry Fitzgerald, Darnell Dockett.
It was a good crop of players,
but he was difficult to deal with. Tried to change a culture that just wasn't into changing.
I spent the whole time he was here trying to get him, because my whole thing is, as you know, kind of goofing around a little bit, having fun when you're doing the job. And became a joke with me, other reporters, is trying to make him one sentence of small talk, just engage in one sentence in small talk. Never did.
That was your goal?
That was my goal, and it failed miserably.
The owner that you had the most difficult time with in your time here in Phoenix?
That's an interesting question, because
how
many donors do we deal with? You know? I mean, obviously, I haven't really had trouble dealing with Robert Sarver I just talked to him the other day. He's trying to tell me he was retired. I'm thinking, if I was retired like you, I'd be fine. But, since we don't deal with owners enough, I don't think, you know? I mean, Michael Bidwell is not accessible. You don't get him unless on his terms.
Did you ever get him?
Just in a PAC situation and we talked politics one time. That was interesting. Mm-hmm. Just as a small talk, he at least did that. And he asked me last time I saw him why I wasn't already retired. You got to admire what he's done with that franchise. I mean, the old man, excuse me, Mr. Bidwell. I shouldn't say this, I suppose, but I have his my last byline might be his obituary, because it's sitting there, has been for like 3 years. What's up? We do, you know, we take older people and we do things.
No, that's part of the business.
But I don't remember. He used to come down and talk to us and go on and on with the same old stories of Al Capone and the racetrack in Chicago.
Yeah.
But then you start talking about the team at all and out the door.
Yeah.
He was a very strange man. So he is a very strange man.
Coyotes?
Their ownership has always evaded me. Mm-hmm. I never really had anything to do with any of those guys. I didn't cover the Coyotes. I mean, they're not my team. They're John Marshall, the other AP.
AP writer, sure.
Writer. That's really his team. I've covered a few hockey games, but.
But you never sat in the Gretzky time or.
I was there during the Gretzky time. And dealt with him and talked to him a number of times and thought, he seems like a nice guy. And so I guess the ownership level of these teams are a little bit. I mean, Jerry Colangelo, we all.
Sure.
It was wonderful when he had the Diamondbacks and the Suns, because I could pick up a phone and get what I needed from the same guy. No problem. Go right through. I could do the same thing now. And so that was a wonderful time. You know.
Why do you think that teams. Is it in this day and age, this is a larger topic, but Bob, do you think that teams just hide behind their websites now? And that if they want to get their message out, they don't want to go to Bob Baum at Associated Press, even though Bob reaches the world. They can just do that through their teams and give it to their employees on their payroll, on their terms, on their time. And, you know, did the role that you had change as the phone came along, as digital media came along, as teams figured out, we don't want to be open, we don't need to be as open as we used to be?
I don't know if they ever were open, but I think they're just more out there than they were then. Mm-hmm. You know, we still do what we do, and our business has changed dramatically. It's one of the reasons I retired is I can't keep up with the technological demands of video.
Tweet this, video that.
The video part is probably the biggest thing. And, yeah. You know, stories have to be short and concise and not much room for nuance. It's just the nature of the beast. It's not just the AP, but we fortunately have, I don't think I've had any layoffs, unlike most newspapers. But, mm-hmm. They have not replaced people. Marshall's going through a fit, probably thinking that he'd have to stay here by himself. They'll replace me, but
they haven't announced it yet.
It's going to be a while, I think. They move slowly on these matters.
Yeah,
but I think it has changed drastically, and I guess it is the teams that have kind of taken hold of it with their own websites and their own Twitter accounts, and some pretty good people writing for him. I mean, really, I mean, mm-hmm. Darren and was a pretty good writer, you know. Mm-hmm.
And Darren Urban.
Urban, yeah. Yeah. And not just him. There's several for the other sites that, you know, I don't know if the Suns have writing on their site, but then you got MLB.com, which is kind of quasi-independent, but they, you know. But you're right, the Cardinals get more access, the Cardinal writers, than we do.
Sure, No, I've had people that have told me that if the Cardinals had it their way, they would just assume not have any media here and just give everything to the Cardinals website. I don't know if that's fact or not. That's just what I've been told. Who do you look at in the media in Phoenix and say, really, when I move, and you're moving to Portland or back to Oregon,
Back to Oregon, middle of nowhere.
Middle of nowhere. But you're going to say, I need to know what this person is thinking.
You mean the most intriguing media member?
Writers, intriguing, or just you look at them and you say, that's a byline or that's something. I need to see what that guy or
that girl
is doing.
I'll read everything Kent Summers writes. I mean, I think I've always thought he was the best writer at the Republic, and now that he's finally got the columnist job that he deserves, I love reading his perspective on things because he's smart and can be funny and incisive, and his take on things are usually right on and fair. So he'd be on my Twitter account, although I'm rebuilding it now.
I saw that.
I'm having to change.
What is it, the retired bomber?
Retired bomber from the Bomber PXO.
On Twitter, the retired bomber. So, I think that's
maybe you can get me some followers.
I laugh so hard on that. Like, that is great.
That's also my Gmail address, and it was amazing to get a Gmail address that didn't require a number. So
yeah. Who are you going to miss most?
Who?
Yeah.
I mean,
in the world
athletes,
of sports, yeah.
Probably Fitz. You know? I mean, he and I grew fairly, I don't know how close, but I'm the only reporter who covered all 15 years of his time here. And it was funny. He came up and gave us a big hug last week or so that I was in the locker room, and he says, Bob, we're going to miss you here. Around here, and I said, "Oh, does that mean you're coming back?" Because at that point, no. Of course he has, but yeah, he's a one of a kind type pro athlete, and he's been awfully good to me. And
has he ever jumped your case?
Oh, lightly. He grabbed my phone to look up a story one time. He says, "Bob, why do you always have to mention how much money I make?" I said, "Because you make a lot of money."
Yeah.
No, he's never. I can't remember him being. I mean, he's been upset about, in general, like when a bunch of those years ago when those tweets from his brother came out or his dad occasionally, and he had to emphatically explain to us, which we became to understand fully, that they had nothing to do with him.
Right.
He's about as careful of crafting of his own image as anybody you'll ever be around. But then the real Fitz isn't a lot different than the one he lets everybody see.
When you weren't here for Barkley...
No, I just missed that.
You just missed it, but the post-Charles, when he's hanging around Phoenix and he decides to unload on the Suns, did you ever get some time with him on any of this?
I never have talked to him at any length of time, although I enjoy it greatly. That one he went on about not even the nachos were cold or whatever, that big rant he went on.
The athlete that you walked into the locker room and you knew, okay, this is going to be teeth pulling, but... I respect the hell out of this person, and this is the story that needs to be told.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm thinking, okay.
It's the beauty of the podcast.
All right. Well, I get allowed to talk.
Sure.
Except, I mean, to think. I mean, somebody was, I knew was going to come clean, even though it was going to be a
difficult... Yeah, you're going to walk down the hallway, and it's all done, and you, the door opens, and you're going to go stand in front of that person. And you know it's going to get confrontational, potentially. It's going to be difficult to get that person to open up. But I got to do my job tonight. May have been a one-time deal, may have been constantly.
I'm trying to think of anybody who fits that bill that's on a local... I mean...
Randy Johnson?
Yeah. That's probably an easy answer of that, isn't it? Yeah.
Not easy. It's. I think that's...
Because he would be difficult win or lose.
His strikeout lines is overrated. When he would say that, strikeouts are overrated.
Right.
I always thought, to me, and I'm not putting thoughts in your head, but I remember that as, you got to explain how you struck out 20 tonight, and you're going to tell us it's overrated.
That's funny, though, because I missed that. He had the wry sense of humor. I wasn't at that 20 strikeout game, and I saw him in a dugout the next night because I was there, and I said, I wasn't here Tuesday. I miss anything? He says, no, just another no decision.
It was. That's great. That is good.
He could be very. Curt Schilling was infinitely more difficult than Randy Johnson, just because of the level of disingenuousness. I'm not trying to avoid the word phony, but I did vote for him for the Hall of Fame this year, so. I didn't let his
but you're fair on that.
I didn't let my personality get in the way. I figured his stats.
There's times where I think where I would see you in your role, not looking specifically at you, but the reporters in general, and I'm not there every single game, and I would say this is going to get interesting tonight. This coach is not going to be handling being pressed on why he's in danger of losing his job or why he did this.
Yeah, I got that from Danny Green. He cut me off before I even got the question out. He
said, were you there when we got crowned, when he pounded his
fist? You know, my tape recorder was there, but I wasn't. It was on his podium because I was filing and I wasn't done yet, so I had somebody put a tape recorder there so I missed it. And he hit the damn thing so hard that it knocked my tape recorder off, knocked it off the floor. So I certainly used it and heard it, and we've used it year after year after year since then. But it was a great moment in Arizona sports history.
Who did you not get to know that you wish now you would have?
Pat Tillman. I mean, I interviewed him a couple of times briefly when he was playing, but I would like to have known. Because in talking to his... Marie, I did a story on the foundation a few years ago, and just in talking to the everything I know about the guy makes me want be interested in him. He would have hated his name used.
You are correct
for pretty much anything. Although I think the foundation would be.
I think Pat's run he would think is cool,
and the foundation the way it helps people.
The Tillman Foundation,
but
yeah.
All the elevating him up to this hero status. He would have hated that. I knew him that well.
Do you come down? Where do you come down on him in the Hall of Fame, Pro Football Hall of Fame?
I don't think so. Well, you're going to put him in the Pro Football Hall of Fame because he left pro football, turned down a contract to go fight, and then end up dying by friendly fire. Is that a reason? Or do you have to just go by what he was as a player?
Mm-hmm.
And he was not a Hall of Fame player. He barely made the team, and he was always an overachiever. His athletic abilities never matched, you know, elite status. Mm-hmm. He was just a good, really hard-playing player. And talk about a great guy to go to for a quote after they were awful.
Yeah.
I won't even say the quote that he gave, but you might imagine.
Yeah.
But
when did you get the phone call on Pat Tillman?
I don't know. I got sent out there that day, and I spent the whole day out at that big shrine that ended up. Guys who knew him better, like Kent, for example, mm-hmm. You know, they're even more upset because it all was so and as it turned out to be even more senseless than.
Sure, I remember when the Tillman documentary came out, and it was being shown in Sedona, Sedona Film Fest, and the Cardinals were in training camp. And I actually asked a couple of the Cardinal people, do you guys want to come down with me and see this tonight? I got a couple passes. No, no, we can't. And I get down there, and the theater is packed, and I had to sit on the floor.
Wow.
And people were yelling at the screen when it got to the, I don't recall, I don't recall, I don't recall, I don't recall, mm-hmm. I don't recall. And it was surreal to see that. When did the phone, give me the story or the thought when the phone rang in the middle of the night with some news that you had to go roust yourself up and put something together? Because I'm sure it didn't happen just once or twice.
You want a news side story or a...
Both.
Because the one I remember, and this really goes back because I believe I was married to my first wife at the time. I got called by the news side in Portland that this guy had... These couple of guys had gone into this bar just before it closed, and it had been a botched robbery attempt, and they were holding all these guys hostage, and I had to go. And I went right there to the fence where all the other SWAT guys were laying on the thing and trying to wait the guy out. And I think it all ended peacefully, but I had to go out there like 1 o'clock in the morning. And then the other time, I'm driving to the Far West Classic. Remember the Far West Classic?
Yeah, sure.
It was a great tournament in its day, but I was on my way to cover that, and all the lights on Sandy Boulevard blinked, and I heard a bulletin on the radio about a plane crash, and this is before cell phones, so I had to stop at a payphone. I called the office, and he said, it's a big one, you got to get out there, so I was United Jetliner, and when I got out there, there it was, just flat on top of an empty house. It had run out of fuel, it turned out what it had done. And all these people were standing around it, and I thought they were onlookers and stuff. And there were people from inside the plane, because only like 20 people died out of it. Anyway, that was quite a night as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah. It's, if you were to look back on events that you covered, asking you your favorite event is a pretty obvious question to ask in a situation like this. I would have to think the Cardinals in a Super Bowl would have to be up there. I would think the Diamondbacks and the World Series would have to be up there. And you may want to go a different direction or take me through those two.
Well, those two are two of my favorite ones. And the World Series might be the one I like the most because, first of all, I always wanted to do a World Series and didn't know how that was ever going to come into an expansion team and, you know, that was ever going to happen. And then... with 9/11 happening right before it, and then the quality of that thing, and to see Ray Charles sing "America the Beautiful" in front of the visitors' dugout there in Chase, whatever it was called then, Bank One Ballpark, that was really something. Stealth bomber flying over, and the games going. I think I was thinking last night was it 4 or 5 games that turned on the last at bat. It was pretty close.
I think it was 4,
and. And I went to New York, and actually, believe it or not, I've been all over the world, but I'd never been to New York before. So I wandered the streets and got kicked out because I got too close to...
You could still smell the smoke.
You could smell.
Yeah.
And something else. It was just an odd smell.
It was bodies. Yeah.
And that was amazing. The Super Bowl thing was totally unexpected. So I remember they got blown out in New England.
Right.
Came back and had their... legendary Christmas practice and took off from there. And who would have thought, you know? And that was a great game. I had it written. I was supposed to write Larry Fitzgerald at MVP because that's what it looked like was going to happen.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, the screen on my flipped upside down. I've never seen it in my life. You know?
Huh.
And it was total. I couldn't stand on my head and write the story. I mean, and so I borrowed the guy next to me's. Laptop to file my story, and the techs had to come fix it. But of course, it all changed from Larry to almost Cardinals type story. So it was such a good game, such a great game.
Have you had time to look back and say, "I wish I would have"?
Not yet, but I'm sure there will be plenty of things. I wish I would have done a lot of things. You know, I wish I'd have been more aggressive on a lot of stories. I wish I'd have looked behind the. You know, more things. I wished I'd, been more, especially in the later years, you know, you get you get to the point where you think you've seen all this, and so you don't really. I don't really charge as hard as I could have.
You know? Do you look back on it and say, I'm glad that I did this? I'm glad I did that. Meaning, you did do these Olympic Games, but maybe there's some stories that were kind of off the beaten path, whether it was in Portland or here, that it's, you know, it was pretty cool that I was able to go do this.
Yeah, the one I told you already was one. I did a story in Salem on a, I can't remember how old he was. He was a 7 or 8 year old, a kid with no legs playing Little League baseball.
Yeah.
And he was the most inspirational kid you want to talk to. He'd gotten hit by a truck when he was like 5 years old. Yeah. And it cut his legs off. But he was determined to play Little League. And years later, my uncle sent me a clip of the kid won the state wrestling championship.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
But that stuff like that, I love doing.
When did you know that it was time to go?
Oh.
When did it hit you? Driving? Walking out of a...
Yeah.
Have you even had that thought?
No. And when something happened and I just dread...
It was work.
Yeah. Dread having to deal with it, you know, saying, oh, God. You know.
Yeah.
Instead of being all aggressive and jumping on it.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I wish I didn't have to do this, you know.
So it's time. So you're moving to Oregon, middle of nowhere. What are you going to do?
Good question. I am going to look for a little, do some writing on the side. I don't exactly know what kind or, I mean, the good thing, as you know here, is that I don't have to be there to write about it necessarily.
Yep.
And
it's the beauty of this.
Right.
Beauty of this. You can be anywhere now.
We'll be doing something. There's a college there. I may try to do something up there, four-year college.
Western Oregon?
Eastern Oregon. Where I went to, I went there for 2 years, many, many years ago. It's the town where the little paper is where I started this 50 years ago when I was 17. So,
what will you miss most?
People I work with, colleagues. I think Mel missed that the most.
Did he?
Because, you know, it's a close-knit community.
You spend more time with them than you do your...
Oh, way more.
Yeah.
And you joke, and they get, you know, nobody ever wanted to sit next to me because I talk so much. And, you know, they joked about how much quieter. But somebody else said it won't be as much fun, so...
Well, I appreciate you coming in, and I don't feel as though that I've seen the last of you. I don't feel as though that I've read the last of you, which is encouraging.
Well, I like hearing that. We'll hopefully write a sentence that makes some sense and move on from there.
It's Bob Baum on this week's edition of the Arizona Media Podcast.